Lowe's knows when you're looking for reliability, the right brand makes all the difference. And now, Lowe's is the exclusive home improvement retailer for the Whirlpool water treatment line, including their Wi-Fi softener, under-sink filtration system, and more. With Whirlpool's proven performance and our everyday low prices, better tasting, better quality water is within reach. Shop pro-trusted brands like Whirlpool and more, in-store or online. Lowe's, we help you save.
Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, full-time college administrator, part-time college professor, but always a true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being very serious. Hey y'all, welcome to part 2 of the updated episode titled Victim of a Narcissist. In 2003, 20-year-old community college student Megan McDonald was brutally beaten and killed in a remote area of Orange County, New York. For over 20 years, the primary suspect in her murder was never publicly revealed. That is, until April 20th, 2023, when the state police announced that they had finally made an arrest, and 42-year-old Edward Hawley, an ex-boyfriend of Megan's, was being charged with second-degree murder. But y'all, there is so much more to this story, so many twists and turns, which will explain why it took police over 20 years to bring charges to the man they adamantly believe is responsible for the crime. So without further ado, let's get started. Dive in too deep. I want to let y'all know that most of this updated information I'm going to share with you came from a series written by journalist Peter D. Kramer for the Journal News, a newspaper part of the USA Today network. And y'all, his reporting is not only extensive and thorough, but it's also exactly what you'd expect from a seasoned reporter. It's objective, unbiased, and he separates fact from opinion. It's filled with information from the most knowledgeable of sources who are closest to this case. So with that, now let's get started. On April 20th, 2023, at 2 in the afternoon, New York State Police held a press conference outside of the Troop F headquarters in Middletown, New York, to announce that they had finally made an arrest in the Megan McDonald murder case from 2003, and they were charging a man by the name of Edward V. Hawley with second-degree murder. During the press conference, police offered the motive as intimate partner violence and the fact that Hawley owed Megan a substantial amount of money. Later, it would be revealed in an extensive internal report by state police that Megan spent her last few hours of March 13, 2003, looking for marijuana. Hawley was her typical contact, but Megan had recently broken off their physical relationship because Hawley owed her that money. So she drove around looking for other possible sources, but came up empty. Along the way, she picked up a friend by the name of Andre Thurston, who police believe sat in her front seat. Then, with no other source to get marijuana, Megan reluctantly turned to Hawley. Police said that Megan was behind the wheel, Thurston was to her right in the front seat, and Hawley was in the back seat, as March 13th turned to March 14th. When Megan parked her car off Bowser Road that night, police believe that something caused Hawley to snap, and he struck her from behind with the hammer, blow after blow, until he killed her, ultimately making her face unrecognizable to first responders. I'm telling you all of this now because it has been the working theory that police have had for years, and I will circle back to it, so put a pin in it. Anyway, back to the news conference announcing Hawley's arrest. While many key individuals were present at the press conference, including the two lead investigators on the case, Lieutenant Brad Natalizio and Michael Corletta, as well as Megan's family, her mom, Betty Jo McDonald, and her sister and brother-in-law, Karen and James Whalen, there was one person noticeably not in attendance, and that was the district attorney for Orange County, David Hoover. Within minutes of the conclusion of the news conference, DA Hoover's office released a statement claiming their office had not been made aware of the arrest until 10:45 that morning, the day of the press conference. The statement also read, quote, "The district attorney's office had previously been informed by the New York State Police that no arrest would be made without prior consultation with our office," end quote. Additionally, in the statement, Hoover said the arrest and murder charge would start the clock on an indictment by a grand jury. He said, quote, "The grand jury must vote an indictment within no longer than 6 days from the date of the arrest, or the defendant must be released. For that reason, complicated cases are normally at least partially presented to a grand jury before an arrest is made. The preferred practice is for police agencies to coordinate with prosecutors on serious cases. Grand jury presentations on cold homicide cases involving complicated fact patterns can rarely be commenced and completed within 6 days without prior coordination," end quote. So basically, Hoover was saying his office was blindsided by the arrest and murder charge. The thing is, though, that's not necessarily true. According to Kramer's reporting, state police had been working with Hoover's office for years, trying to take the case before a grand jury, but Hoover continuously blocked their efforts at every turn. He insisted that the case was not ready to be tried, and he repeatedly said that it was up to him, as the DA, to determine whether the case would go to a grand jury or not. Finally, state police got tired of waiting, and they went around Hoover to ultimately make the arrest of Edward Hawley. So, obviously, there is a strained relationship, at the very least, between police in Orange County and DA Hoover, or bad blood, if you will. But to explain this bad blood, I need to go back to 2008, 5 years after Megan's murder. At the time, Hoover was just weeks into a new job as a defense attorney at a Chester-based law firm, which was fresh from a position he had had with the U.S. Department of Justice. Before that, Hoover spent years as an assistant district attorney under the Orange County DA Frank Phillips, who was in office until 2013. So, I say all that to say that it's safe to say that Hoover was well aware of the inner workings of both sides of the law, both as a defender and a prosecutor. In 2008, however, when he was working at the private law firm, he began working with a client whom he said had possible connections to the Megan McDonald murder case. Now, Hoover never identified this client, at least not at the time, but he did speak with an assistant district attorney, Mary Ellen Black Albanese, who had been handling Megan's case since the day her body was found in March 2003. According to Kramer's reporting, Albanese and Hoover first spoke on July 30th, 2008, and they would continue to speak at least 9 additional times over the course of the next few years until their final call on May 12th, 2011. According to Albanese's personal notes, as documented and reported by Peter D. Kramer for the Journal News, during their first conversation, Hoover told Albanese, quote, "I have a client who approached me about potentially negotiating a deal. He was involved in the Megan McDonald case. The bottom line is he could produce 2 others who were involved, and he had some information that a Stanley ball peen hammer was used," end quote. Later in the conversation, Hoover added that his unnamed client knew where the hammer was and that it was possibly part of a 3-piece set. Hearing this information, Albanese asked Hoover if his client was a principal or an accomplice in the murder, and he replied, quote, "Principal or accomplice, there's very little distinguishing that here. They were all acting in concert. One person might be after the fact," end quote. But then Hoover went on and added, quote, "If I were you, I would want to know more," end quote. According to Albanese's notes, Hoover mocked the investigator's theory at the time that the murder was drug-related. He said, quote, "The motive described to me was much different, that something sort of happened and got out of control," end quote. And as for his client's reasoning for coming forward, Hoover told Albanese, quote, "I assume the reason this person wanted to turn themselves in was because police stepped up their investigation," end quote. In other words, it seemed, police were close to, like, closing in on his client, and his client felt the pressure. So his unnamed client wanted Hoovler to try to negotiate a plea deal. But during this conversation, Hoovler never revealed the identity of his client to Albanese. Instead, he offered, quote, "Tell the police to keep knocking at doors. You'll know you're in the ballpark if you knock at someone's door and they give you my card," end quote. And that was the end of the first contact between Hoovler and ADA Albanese. In the remaining 9 conversations, particularly those that occurred in 2008, Albanese never learned anything that investigators could actually act on. Rather, each time they talked, Hoovler revealed less and less information, other than the fact that he felt like 3 to 9 years would be a sufficient charge for manslaughter. But eventually, both Hoovler and his client lost interest in plea discussions, especially as police moved on and started exploring other potential suspects, and the attention steered away from Hoovler's client. But what Albanese and police at the time did not know was that they had already interviewed Hoovler's client on more than one occasion, from what I gather. And sure enough, they had been suspicious of him. So suspicious, in fact, that they considered this client of Hoovler's to be suspect number 2. Edward Hawley, of course, was suspect number 1. But suspect number 2, that was Andre Thurston, the guy who was in the front seat of Megan's car and witnessed the entire attack and murder, and from what it sounds like, potentially played a part in the murder. The thing is, though, Hoovler never revealed that this client of his was Andre Thurston, at least not until way later, after Hoovler had already been elected as DA, and after Andre Thurston had died. According to Kramer's reporting for the Journal News, Thurston died of a drug overdose on March 20th, 2010, just days after the 7th anniversary of Megan's death. And he died without ever revealing to investigators what he knew about Megan's murder.
Lowe's knows when you're looking for reliability, the right brand makes all the difference. And now, Lowe's is the exclusive home improvement retailer for the Whirlpool water treatment line, including their Wi-Fi softener, under-sink filtration system, and more. With Whirlpool's proven performance and our everyday low prices, better tasting, better quality water is within reach. Shop pro-trusted brands like Whirlpool and more, in-store or online. Lowe's. We help, you save.
So let us now fast forward to November of 2013, when Hoovler was elected DA in Orange County, nearly 4 years after Thurston had died. Actually, Hoovler took over for Frank Phillips, the DA he had previously worked under as an assistant DA. But when Hoovler became DA, he had multiple opportunities to recuse himself from Megan McDonald's case. I mean, even though he had yet to reveal that he had represented Andre Thurston, it was still a conflict of interest, so recusing oneself seems like the most obvious choice. According to Kramer's reporting, Hoovler could have either identified active cases he had worked on as a defense attorney and then recused himself from handling them as DA. He could have waited until the first time police asked for a warrant or subpoena in Megan's case and then recused himself then. Or he could have even set up a certain chain of command within the DA's office that would have sent all decisions regarding Megan's case to a specific assistant DA. But Hoovler chose none of those things, and he continued to work on the case regardless of the conflict of interest that existed. And for the longest time, he was the only one who knew the conflict existed in the first place. The primary question, though, is why? Why did Hoovler insist on staying on the Megan McDonald case, which is still a lingering question today in 2024? But for now, let's continue with the timeline. Y'all, it wasn't until March 20th, 2019, the 9th anniversary of Thurston's death, that Hoovler named his 2008 client for the first time in a meeting with police and members of his staff. But at the meeting, Hoovler told everyone that Thurston never specified which homicide he had information about, only that he had information about a homicide. But based on Albanese's notes, we know that isn't true. Hoovler had definitely clarified that it was Megan's murder from the outset as the one that his client witnessed. So it seemed that police had now caught Hoover in a blatant lie. Then, in March of 2022, police were conducting a big media push around the 19th anniversary of Meghan's death. The USA Today network ran a story with never-before-released details of the murder, and police hoped it would prompt Holly to slip up and either confess or reveal key pieces of information about the murder. According to Kramer's reporting, Holly's wife was in jail at the time, but Holly was free. Days after the story was published, police began listening to recorded jailhouse calls between Holly and his wife, and they were shocked at what they heard. Holly told his wife that the head district attorney called Holly's lawyer to set up a meeting. Holly said the DA, referring to Hoover, told his attorney that Holly was the prime suspect in Meghan's murder, and apparently Hoover warned them that law enforcement might be listening to their phone calls. Then Holly told his wife that Hoover had offered him a plea deal. If Holly told what he knew, then he would not have to serve time in a maximum security prison. As police listened to the conversations, they were flabbergasted. I mean, just as they were closing in on the guy they truly believed was responsible for Meghan's murder, they felt like Hoover was directly tampering with their investigation, especially because the only way they learned about the plea offer was through the jailhouse phone calls rather than from Hoover himself. Like, was he trying to hide something? They were even more frustrated because the jail calls had provided important information and a window into Holly's thinking. But after Holly revealed the information to his wife, that was allegedly from his attorney through Hoover, all the jail calls abruptly came to a halt. About a month later, on April 26, 2022, Hoover acted as the MC for an Orange County crime victim vigil where he introduced families whose lives had been tragically affected by crime. Among the speakers he introduced were Meghan's sister and brother-in-law, Karen and James Whalen. After introducing them, Hoover took Lieutenant Natalizio aside and asked him how the case was coming along. Then, at some point during the conversation, Hoover told Natalizio that he had represented Andre Thurston on a drug case, but, quote, had little to no information about the details of the homicide or even Thurston's involvement, end quote. But Natalizio was already familiar with ADA Albanese's record of events, so Natalizio mentioned her notes from their previous conversations, and he pointed out that her notes indicate that Hoover not only discussed Meghan's case specifically, but he also talked about the murder weapon and a manslaughter plea deal. Natalizio later recalled in a state police report that Hoover appeared to be flustered after this. In response, Hoover asked Natalizio to meet him later that same night at a local diner in Walk Hill to talk through the case. Natalizio agreed, and once at the diner, Hoover changed his story yet again. Apparently, Hoover told Natalizio that Thurston came to him because he was worried he would be arrested for selling drugs once. Thurston said he had information about a homicide, he talked about a murder weapon, and according to Hoover, Thurston asked legal questions about being an accomplice, but that he never said the murder victim was Meghan McDonald. Then Hoover said Thurston only came to his office once, and then Hoover never heard from Thurston again. He also said Thurston never paid him. The thing is, this completely contradicts the notes from Hoover's first initial call, which actually wasn't to Albanese, but rather to senior ADA John Geidel. And he, Geidel, is actually the one who sent the tip to Albanese since she was responsible for Meghan's case since day one. According to notes from Hoover's initial call to Geidel, quote, Hoover represented one of the persons involved in the murder of Meghan McDonald, and his client may be willing to turn themselves in if offered a plea agreement, end quote. Before the conclusion of their dinner at the local diner, Hoover told Natalizio that if ADAs Leah Canton and Stu Rosenwasser agreed that investigators had enough evidence to make an arrest, then he'd sign off on taking the case to a grand jury. However, Hoover warned Natalizio that he did not believe the prosecution would be able to pull out a win. A few months later, in August of 2022, Hoover assigned Canton and another prosecutor, Christopher Kelly, to work with Natalizio and Corletta on Meghan's case. And, according to Kramer's reporting, the team made progress. Over the course of 11 different meetings, from August 12, 2022 to February 23, 2023, they poured over 20 years worth of evidence and put together a 26-page case to take to a grand jury. By March 2023, Canton and Kelly were ready to present their probable cause memo to their boss, Hoover, which they planned to do on March 14th, the 20th anniversary of Megan's death. But before they could get to that, something happened on March 10th that quickly pumped the brakes on their plan. According to Kramer's reporting, it began with a request from a TV reporter to do a one-on-one interview with DA Hoover regarding Megan's case. Hoover agreed to the interview, but when state police heard about it, they voiced their very real concerns, because they had worked hard to put together a carefully crafted media campaign which they were using to try to reach Holly. So an unscripted DA could definitely harm those efforts if he were to say the wrong thing. So State Police Captain Joe Kolek called Hoover and told him that a DA doing an interview about a 20-year-old cold case was a bit unusual, and Kolek asked if, at the very least, his investigators could sit in on the interview. Kolek explained that they didn't want any other surprises, you know, like what they had had with Holly's jail calls. But Hoover responded to Kolek by saying, quote, "I'm the sitting DA, and I can make these calls," end quote. Hoover went on to express his serious doubts about the strength of the case and the probable cause against Holly. He repeatedly told Kolek, quote, "This case will not be moving forward unless we can convict," end quote. However, Hoover also said that he believed that one day Holly would confess as his health deteriorated. Regardless, by the end of the call, Hoover told Kolek that the investigators could sit in on his interview. But 5 minutes later, he called Kolek back and told him he was canceling the interview altogether. According to Kramer's reporting in the Journal News, Kolek hung up the phone after that conversation, feeling like Hoover would continue to drag his feet and would never actually put the case before a grand jury. After the call with Kolek, still on the same day of March 10th, 2023, Hoover called ADA Christopher Kelly, who was actually in a meeting with Corletta at the time. When Kelly answered, Hoover was yelling so loudly that investigator Corletta could hear everything as if the call were on speakerphone. Hoover proceeded to accuse Kelly of backing state police, and he questioned the information that they had been sharing. Hoover stressed to Kelly that the FBI profile, you know, the profile of Holly that the BAU worked up, was inadmissible. However, Kelly was able to talk his boss down, and Kelly told Hoover that he truly felt like they had enough evidence to prosecute. Kelly also offered to walk Hoover through the entire 26-page probable cause memo and go over the bullet points with him that supported their evidence. By the end of the call, Hoover had calmed down. However, according to a report by state police, quote, "It was apparent that DA Hoover was not aware of the facts of the case," end quote. It wasn't long after this that Hoover once again changed his mind. He had initially told Natalizio at the diner that if ADAs Leah Canton and Stu Rosenwasser recommended the case move forward, he would sign off on it. But now, almost a year later, Hoover changed his tune again, and he said that Leah Canton's opinion was no longer valid. He now wanted ADA Chris Borick's and Rosenwasser's approval, saying, quote, "Leah is too close to it. She helped write it," end quote. On March 29th, 2023, something happened that was the final straw for state police. On this day, Hoover watched as police divers combed a lake reservoir looking for the weapon used in Megan's murder. There, Hoover told Captain Kolek that he did not want the case to move forward until Holly confessed to the murder, primarily because they could lose the case. Hoover told Kolek, quote, "As of right now, we're not there. If we wait, we will get there. I promise you that at some point before you retire and I'm no longer the DA, this will be solved," end quote. But Kolek flat out told Hoover that they were not prepared to wait for a confession. Kolek said, quote, "We believe that you and your office can get this to the finish line," end quote. In response, Hoover reminded Kolek that it was his call to make and only his call alone. Hoover said, quote, "You can go make an arrest tomorrow and I'll stand up at the podium and say this case isn't prosecutable," end quote. By April 12, 2023, state police had had enough. They were prepared to bypass DA Hoover, but not before seeking advice elsewhere. So on April 12th, New York State Police Major Paul DeQuarto, Captain Joe Kolek, Lieutenant Nat Alizio, and Lieutenant Christopher Williams, as well as State Police 3rd in Command, Field Commander Colonel Richard S. Allen, and Division Counsel John Chaika, presented the case to members of the New York State Attorney General's Office. Now, I'm not sure exactly how this meeting went, because according to Kramer's reporting, some with the state police considered it a precursor to a formal request for the Attorney General's Office to take a role in Megan's case. But the Attorney General's Office said no formal request was ever submitted. Also, according to a state police report written by Nat Alizio, the Attorney General's Office asked Hoover to recuse himself, but according to the report, he declined. However, the Attorney General's Office disputed this claim and said no call to Hoover ever happened. Regardless, whatever the outcome of this meeting was, state police decided to move forward with an arrest of Edward Hawley. Instead of an indictment, which comes from a grand jury by way of the DA, Corletta issued a 17-page felony complaint against Hawley, essentially sidestepping Hoover and his office. So, on April 20th, 2023, Hawley was arrested at the Orange County Jail, where he was already in custody on a drug charge. He was transported to the Troop F barracks for the press conference announcing his arrest and his second-degree murder charge. There, he was wheeled out in a wheelchair, where he declared his innocence and love for Megan, before he was ultimately taken to his arraignment. Now, side note, you might have noticed I mentioned that Hawley was in a wheelchair. Apparently, he lost the use of his legs in a car crash back in 2007. Anyway, moving on. Remember, DA Hoover refused to attend the press conference announcing Hawley's arrest. But Megan's family was there, and they had something to say, specifically calling out Hoover, though never saying his name. James Whalen, Megan's brother-in-law, said, quote, "We say today, all eyes are now on you. We are all watching. Megan's family, the community, and the media. Justice for Megan does not only mean handcuffs at this point. This monster, this coward, has been able to live free nearly as long as Megan was alive on this earth. Megan's family will continue the fight." End quote. 5 days after the press conference, on April 25th, 2023, Hoover held a meeting in the Government Center in Goshen, where his office is located, and he summoned to the meeting Megan's living family members, her mom, her sister, and her brother-in-law, as well as several members of Hoover's executive staff. Now, this was too many people to meet on the fourth floor of the building where his office is, so the meeting occurred on the third floor, where he told Megan's family that he wasn't taking the case to a grand jury in the grand jury room. I mean, if that doesn't speak volumes about a person, I'm not sure what does. Anyway, the next day, on April 26, 2023, Hoover did what he said for years that he wasn't going to do. He formally recused himself and his office from the case, and he asked for a special prosecutor to take over. As a result, Julia Cornaccio and Laura Murphy took over the case on May 3, 2023. Cornaccio is a veteran Westchester prosecutor, and Murphy, also a veteran prosecutor, previously led the Westchester District Attorney's Cold Case Bureau. Now, this is what both the state police and Megan's family had been requesting for a while, that Hoover recuse himself because of his past representation of Andre Thurston. Karen and James Whalen backed this up, saying, quote, "David Hoover's conflict of interest existed on day one. Hoover woke up every single day between January 1st, 2014 and April 26, 2023, a total of 3,402 days, and willingly chose not to recuse himself," end quote. But the Whalens went on to claim, quote, "David Hoover's conduct is so outrageous that it is hard to believe. He seems laser focused on trashing the brave men and women of the state police to hide his own conduct. We are convinced that there is far more to this story, and we suspect that David Hoover is continuing to hide the truth and attack the state police in order to keep his personal and professional lives and reputation from being destroyed," end quote. Now, also on April 26th, 6 days after Hawley's arrest with no indictment from a grand jury, Hawley was let go after having served his sentence on the drug charge. In other words, because of a legal loophole, Hawley was set free just days after he was officially arrested for second-degree murder. Although this wasn't the best outcome that New York State Police could ask for, they still believed the arrest and charges were a sign of progress, finally, because it meant that Holly could not leave the area or flee the state. Plus, they had charged the guy they suspected all along, and they had gotten past the man who stood in their way. Megan's family, however, shared how they felt about Holly being released even after he was finally arrested and charged with Megan's murder. And they still pointed the finger at Hoover. Karen and James Whalen said, quote, "It was a knife in our hearts for Ed Holly to go free, due solely to the actions of David Hoover. David Hoover, who chose not to attend the press conference announcing Ed Holly's arrest and refused to appear in court himself to announce his recusal. He can pretend to be outraged at this reporting, but everyone involved in the case knows a simple truth. Because of David Hoover, Ed Holly has not spent one night in jail for the murder of Megan McDonald." End quote. Now, as I said at the beginning of the episode, most of this update I've shared with you today came from Peter Kramer's reporting. However, his information primarily came from an internal report written by Lieutenant Brad Natalizio for the New York State Police, who became the lead investigator on Megan's case in 2017. He was later joined by investigator Michael Corletta, and together the two spent hundreds of hours working round the clock to solve one of New York's most prominent cold cases. Eventually, Natalizio transferred to the Major Crimes Division and Corletta became the lead investigator, but Natalizio still stayed on the case. Together, it was their teamwork and tireless dedication that ultimately led to the arrest. So the extensive internal report included information from the most knowledgeable top law enforcement officials. With that, the report was released in 2023, and the USA Today Network New York obtained a copy of it. According to Kramer's reporting, the report documents the police's deep distrust of Hoover for reasons that I've already explained, and it paints Hoover in quote-unquote stark and unflattering terms. So, doing his due diligence as a fair, balanced, and unbiased journalist, Kramer reached out to Hoover to give him a chance to rebut and respond to the accusations. In November 2023, the USA Today Network sent Hoover 8 specific questions about the state police report and his decision-making process in Megan's case as the DA. They also offered to sit down with him for a formal interview. A few days later, Hoover responded by sending the following statement via email. The statement read, quote, "The ethical rules regarding pretrial publicity, the order appointing the special district attorneys, and the duty I owe to a former client are very clear and prevent me from commenting upon the evidence or answering your questions. However, any suggestion that I or anyone in my office did anything to tamper with or in some fashion compromise the investigation into Ms. McDonald's death is so categorically false as it is offensive." End quote. He also stated that he never denied state police, quote, "any resource to pursue any investigative avenue that might advance this investigation and bring closure to Ms. McDonald's family, as well as our entire community," end quote. Instead, he said, he approved spending tens of thousands of dollars on, quote, "sophisticated and cutting-edge scientific testing, and I have explored the use of novel technologies never previously admitted in the courts of New York, all in an effort to solve this 20-year-old homicide," end quote. Hoover went on to tell USA Today that police were well aware of his representation of Andre Thurston even prior to him taking office as DA in 2014, according to Hoover. But they weren't aware of it because he didn't reveal who his client was until 2019. Anyway, regarding his recusal of himself after Holly's arrest, Hoover offered, quote, "The court agreed with my view that after the arrest, my representation of Mr. Thurston raised the prospect of an appearance of impropriety and issued an order of appointing 2 highly qualified prosecutors," end quote. Then he added that his office has extended the new prosecutors every courtesy as they've been pursuing the investigation and catching up on 20 years of evidence. He said he hopes that they are, quote, "able to successfully navigate the many complexities presented by this matter," end quote. A couple months later, in January 2024, Hoover sent an additional statement to the USA Today Network New York, basically explaining his ethical obligation in the case. Hoover's statement read, quote, "A prosecutor is ethically required, even to the great disappointment to the public, to refrain from accusing anyone of criminality unless and until sufficient evidence is gathered to support such charges against an individual to the exclusion of all other suspects. This ethical rule has particular application with regard to any notorious case from the distant past where the understandable desire for resolution weighs heaviest." End quote. Finally, however, Hoover did end up sitting down and doing an accompanying interview with USA Today. Kramer reported that Hoover defended his cooperation with police and stated that he granted over 233 requests over 9 years, which he said ranged from subpoenas to DNA to manpower to legal advice. Hoover said, quote, "Anything they asked for, they got. I'm not talking about anything in the 7 months the special prosecutor has had in the case. I'm talking about up till the day they made the arrest. Everything they asked for, they got. There is no claim they can make that they didn't get. The only thing they didn't like was get more evidence," end quote. So a lot of the bad blood between New York State Police, who worked on Megan's case, and DA Hoover can be boiled down to he said, he said. But the facts that we do know, which are important to the story, are A, Edward Hawley was arrested without an indictment after a 20-year investigation. B, DA Hoover was a no-show at the press conference announcing Hawley's arrest. C, Hawley was released from custody less than a week after his arrest due to the 6-day grand jury indictment rule or law. And D, Hoover finally recused himself from the case after the arrest, noting a, quote, "substantial appearance of a conflict of interest," end quote, which is an ethical concern he had not raised in his previous 9 years as DA. So I think the big question is why? Like, what was Hoover's actual motive for recusing himself all these years later and not recusing himself way back at the beginning of his appointment as DA in 2014? Well, in his reporting, Peter D. Kramer lays out 4 possible reasons, or more like questions to Hoover's motive. And I would be remiss if I didn't share those with you, because it really does get those wheels turning. So, 1, was his motive simply the fear of losing a high-profile murder case? 2, were his decisions politically driven? Perhaps he had a fear of voter backlash when his involvement with a suspect in Megan's murder came to light. 3, was it more personal than that? According to Kramer, Hoover's son attended the same Catholic high school that Megan did. That community is still mourning Megan's death to the point that there is a stained glass window in the student chapel dedicated in Megan's memory. So perhaps, was he worried that community would think less of him? I mean, how many times had he been approached at football games and pep rallies and asked when her murder would be solved? Or 4, was it all about pride? Did Hoover refuse any request to step away from the case because he wanted to be the one to solve it? He wanted the credit and the hype that goes with it. I'm not sure we will ever know, but all of the tension between state police and Hoover has left Edward Hawley's lawyer, Paul Weber, scratching his head. He said, quote, "There's something more going on here. I don't know if it's the district attorney and the state police are butting heads, but there's something going on here with this case. Unless the state police take action on the allegations they are making, the document is nothing more than a blame game, a way for the state police to save face when this whole case goes down the tubes," end quote. Now, as if all of this isn't enough controversy in the case, just wait, there's more. It's kind of a separate thing, like it's not necessarily connected to Hoover, but it is about one of the judges who presided over court proceedings in Megan's case. And that is Orange County Judge Craig Stephen Brown. Essentially, this boils down to a bunch of legalese and the question of ethical responsibilities of Judge Brown. Apparently, it started when Brown's brother-in-law, Jason Rivera, needed legal advice sometime after 2008, which he sought from Brown. State police began questioning Rivera's connection to Hawley, especially after Rivera told them he knew Hawley because they used to play basketball together in Wallkill at a local park. After this, Rivera became a key person of interest, according to Natalizio's internal report, due to his relationship with their main suspect during the time frame of the murder. So, in early March of 2019, Brown called senior investigator Kevin Chorzimpa and asked him a question off the record. Brown proceeded to ask him if Rivera was sought as a background witness or a material witness. In other words, was Rivera a suspect in Megan's case? The thing is, Chorzimpa couldn't really answer his question because he was no longer a member of state police in Middletown, New York. He had moved on to state police in Ellenville. Regardless, the phone call mattered to investigators on Megan's case because within days of placing it, on March 12, 2019, Brown denied a key search warrant for police to tap Holly's phone. According to Kramer's reporting for the Journal News, Brown based his denial on lack of probable cause. So, essentially, this whole situation caused state police to lose faith in Judge Brown. Then that faith was further diminished when he once again denied a search warrant for Holly's Google accounts in 2020. And once again, Brown said he denied it because of lack of probable cause. Now, Brown said he called state police initially to see if he needed to recuse himself from the case or not. Like, what exactly did they have against his brother-in-law? Brown explained, quote, "If someone is brought in for background and there's no indication that they have anything to do with it other than that, that's why I needed to know that answer to that question in order to make an informed decision. It seems to make sense to me, because the interviews appeared to be background, not related to him being a witness or him being a suspect. So if that were the case, then there is no appearance and there is no conflict. So I was calling to confirm whether or not state police had information that would give rise to my recusal or not," end quote. However, according to Rick Trunfillo, a former DA and now an adjunct professor at Syracuse University School of Law and Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs, Brown's phone call and continued involvement in Megan's case are cause for concern. Trunfillo said, quote, "When a judge recognizes a conflict such as that, where he actually makes a call to the agency who's applying for that warrant, asking whether his relative is involved, it may have been more prudent to have disqualified himself and immediately transferred that to another judge or notified them that he could not act on this warrant," end quote. However, Trunfillo also suggested that just because investigators perceived a conflict, it doesn't necessarily mean Brown's rulings and denials of warrants were incorrect. Trunfillo said, quote, "The warrants could have very well lacked the evidentiary proof necessary to satisfy the requirements of the Fourth Amendment," end quote. Now, I'm not sure when, but at some point, Town Court Judge Peter Green took the case. Based on the timeline of reporting, I think Green took over around the same time or a little after that the new special prosecutors took over in May 2023. So that brings us to the big question that I'm sure has been burning in the back of your brain during this whole episode. Where does this case sit today in September 2024? Well, I'm happy to report that things have finally been moving along through the court system. On January 29th, 2024, the new special prosecutors, Cornaccio and Murphy, finally took the case to a grand jury, which handed up a single second-degree murder indictment for Edward Holly. The indictment then moved the case from Walk Hill Town Court to the county court in Goshen, which was then taken over by Orange County Judge Hyun-Chin Kim. She set Holly's bail at $1 million or $500,000 cash, and Holly has remained behind bars ever since. Now, fast forward through several court dates, hearings, etc., but the most recent hearing, called a Huntley hearing, came on September 6th, just a couple weeks ago. According to the reporting of Lana Bellamy for the Times Union, the hearing was meant to determine if Holly's statements to police before his arrest were, quote, "appropriately and voluntarily given, and if they could be used during a trial," end quote. After 2 days of hearing testimony, it was ultimately adjourned until October 2nd, which is the earliest date that prosecutors, Holly's defense team, and the judge would be available again. Judge Kim, however, anticipated that she will likely issue a decision on the matter sometime in November of this year. Kim also said that if the court worked efficiently, a trial could begin as early as January 7th, 2025. Both sides of the case anticipate that the trial will last for at least a month. So, that means there will be a part 3 of this updated case. Once the trial gets underway and once a verdict is handed down, I will be sure to release a special episode of Campus Crime Chronicles to update you and ultimately, hopefully, provide a resolution to this now nearly 22-year-old homicide case. Okay, y'all, that officially brings us to the end of part 2 of this updated chronicle. As always, be sure to check out my social media where I always post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. Or you can follow my personal account at Nicole K. Lynn on Instagram. That's NicoleKaylynn. Okay, well, that's all for today. So bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner, and it's edited and produced by GRE Gassaway. Campus crony Alexis McDonald is my research assistant. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next Chronicle.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains August 8th through the 14th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.